listening to Spill
on KBOO Portland 90.7 FM.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Development and Events Committee meets on the third Monday of the month at 5:30 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
We know a KBOO community membership is at the top of everyone's wish list this season. Give the gift of supporting grassroots community media by making a donation during KBOO's Catalog of Connections campaign now through December 31st. Our $75,000 goal will go towards everyone's favorite music, news, and public affairs programming all year long. Just go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Thank you and happy holidays.
Welcome to Yes Presents Rising Up with Sonali, your weekly antidote to the doom and gloom of mainstream news, lifting up solutions that bring us closer to economic, racial, gender, and environmental justice. I'm Sonali Kohatkar, Senior Editor at Yes Media. This week, we'll highlight a dangerous bill that the House of Representatives passed in late November, H.R. 9495, dubbed the Nonprofit Killer Bill. My guest, Jenna Ruddock of the media democracy organization Free Press, will explain what's at stake and why Congress should instead pass the Press Act, codifying basic press freedoms. Then Carnegie Mellon Professor Joe Trotter joins us to give a sweeping history of black-led cities and how they paint a story of racial capitalism and reparations owed. It's the topic of his newest book, Building the Black City, The Transformation of American Life. And finally, we'll mark the 40th anniversary of the largest industrial accident in world history and the ongoing decades-long fight for justice for the survivors of the Bhopal disaster. Amnesty International's Mark Dummett will explain how people are continuing to suffer while Dow Chemical drags its feet and how justice can be won. That's coming up in just a moment. This is Yes Presents Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, Senior Editor at Yes Media. You can find this program at yesmagazine.org, watch it on Free Speech TV, and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. The United States House of Representatives in late November passed a dangerous piece of legislation that many are calling the Nonprofit Killer Bill. In spring of this year, when the bill was discussed as a means to silence pro-Palestinian activism, and when Democratic Party nominee Kamala Harris might have been favored to win, dozens of House Democrats supported it. But after Donald Trump's White House win, some among them initially blocked H.R. 9495 on a technicality amid fears that the incoming president would use it as a tool to bludgeon his perceived enemies. It was then reintroduced, voted on with significantly less Democratic support, and passed. But really, should it have been introduced or passed to begin with, no matter what the political winds of the time? Journalists and their advocates are instead urging the passage of the Press Act. Joining me to tell us all about it is Jenna Ruddock, Policy Counsel at the media democracy organization Free Press, where her work focuses on digital civil rights, surveillance, protest, and tech. She's also a researcher, documentary photographer, and a producer with a background in community media and factual streaming. Welcome to the program, Jenna.
Thank you so much for having me.
Before we get to what the Press Act is and why it's a really important piece of legislation, let's talk about the importance of the so-called nonprofit killer bill, as many are calling it, and why it's so dangerous that so many organizations and individuals are urging that it not pass the Senate. It's already passed the House. And essentially, it's supposed to have something to do, the title has something to do with taxes, and also it's a Terror Financing and Tax Penalties on American Hostages Act. But it's really, as far as I can tell, the danger of it has nothing to do with American hostages. What would H.R. 9495 do if the Senate were to pass its own version?
Yeah, so as you mentioned, the bill was initially introduced in April, and at that point, it only included the so-called terror financing provisions, which I'll get into. In September, when it was reintroduced, it was packaged in with provisions about reducing tax penalties for Americans held hostage or detained abroad. And so those two pieces were pushed together in September. But the really concerning provision that we have raised alarms about is in H.R. 9495 is the so-called terror financing provisions. And what it would really do is it would enable the political targeting of nonprofits, including nonprofit newsrooms. And it would do that by giving the Secretary of the Treasury, who is an administration official appointed by the president, almost unilateral discretion to designate a nonprofit as a terrorist supporting organization. And within 90 days of that designation, strip the nonprofit of its tax exempt status if the organization isn't able to rebut the accusations to the Treasury Secretary's satisfaction. And the real concern here is that the bill circumvents existing due process because the activities it's supposedly concerned with, which is material support for terrorism, is already illegal under federal law. But what this bill would do is that it would effectively shift the burden of proof from the government to civil society.
Civil society is represented in part or often has its sort of voice and advocacy done through the nonprofit world. Meanwhile, you have for-profit corporations that now are going to have far more representation in the halls of power in government. You know, Trump's cabinet, if the Senate passes, his appointees will be filled with billionaires. They also, of course, have the money to spend on super PACs, thanks to Citizens United. Their political speech is, you know, available aplenty. They can do what they want with it. And nonprofits are already bound, not just by not speaking out in favor of terrorism, but also simply by speaking in favor of political candidates or not, right? I mean, there's so much self-censorship that already goes on because nonprofit organizations and media are scared of running afoul of 501c3 rules. Is that fair?
Yeah, I think absolutely. The tax code, like you mentioned, this bill is focused on the tax code, and that already creates constraints for organizations who want to protect their tax-exempt status.
And so you have a situation where you have an incoming president who has already promised basically to punish his political enemies, those in the media and outside it who critiqued him. Months ago, Democrats thought it would be, when they were against pro-Palestinian activism, thought it was perfectly fine to, and many of them, like I believe way more than the, 50 of them supported it initially. But really, it all does depend on who's in power and who is able to wield unaccountable power, right? Democrats should have opposed it no matter what. All members of the House should have opposed it no matter what, because the next time it could be maybe a Democratic president coming in and waving that law in front of or against conservative media, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's nothing about the bill itself that is partisan. And the authority that it would create would enable any administration to abuse it again and use it to target nonprofits. So I think that's something that has not been as foregrounded in the conversation, but really should be really right at the core.
Are you worried? I mean, when you have these kinds of tools that can be so easily abused, are you worried about the fact that it's also, of course, going to curtail good journalism? I mean, I remember it wasn't that long ago when, after the September 11th attacks, we had the USA Patriot Act, and it just cast such a chill within civil society, within media, within, you know, I was an immigrant journalist and was terrified of being deported for doing my job as a journalist because of the USA Patriot Act. We've been here before in a place where free speech is curtailed under the guise of thwarting terrorism, right? And it wasn't good.
Absolutely. And like you mentioned, there are risks to individual journalists depending on their particular circumstances. We've also seen this as a part of the broader criminalization of movements and news organizations and reporters who cover those movements and get caught up in aggressive policing and prosecution of movements, especially movements for racial justice and around environmental justice and the climate. And so there's this very real kind of background environment that we've been contending with for a long time now of increasing criminalization of movements that impacts the reporters trying to cover the movements and the issues they're trying to raise. And that has often involved the weaponization of charges around extremism and terrorism.
Now, how likely is it that the Senate would pass its version of the bill? If it passes, I assume Trump would happily sign it into law, right?
Yeah, so we're at a point in the year where the Senate doesn't have a lot of time left on its calendar. It seems very unlikely that it will pass through this Senate at this point, but we are, at this point, not even a few weeks away from a new Congress. So while it's pretty unlikely that it will pass through the current Senate, it can easily be reintroduced next Congress. It will have to go back through the House and again through the Senate, but it will face a much more favorable political environment.
Right, because of course, if the current Senate doesn't take it up, next year you have the Republican Party controlling the House, controlling the Senate, controlling the White House, and they can basically pass any piece of legislation as long as the party itself is united around it. A terrifying prospect indeed, given that the Republican Party has not exactly been very friendly to independent nonprofit media. Let's talk about what journalists and nonprofit media would like to see passed. And this is the Press Act. Your organization Free Press put out an alert. What is the Press Act? Why would it allow speech to flourish rather than curtailed as the H.R. 9495 does?
The Press Act would codify what I would suspect most people would think of as very basic protections for journalists. It would codify protections against journalists being compelled by the federal government to disclose information gathered through their reporting, including information about their sources. And these protections under the bill would also extend to companies that provide telecommunication services to journalists and newsrooms. So that's companies like phone and internet services. So again, we're talking about kind of codifying really fundamental protections that enable reporters to do their jobs safely.
What sort of support does that bill have in Congress? I mean, we hear a lot about supporting a free press and free speech. Is there support, enough support to pass it? And if so, why hasn't it passed?
The bill has had pretty broad support in Congress and bipartisan support. It passed through the House of Representatives. It is also now sitting in the Senate and unfortunately seems unlikely to move before the end of this Congress. But a significant complicating factor came from Donald Trump when he chose to speak out expressly against this bill and go online and post, in all caps, "Republicans must kill this bill," which seems to have dampened the prospects of it moving at all, despite this bipartisan support that existed in the past.
And it's terrifying because, you know, we have a legislative branch of government which is supposed to discuss and pass or not pass pieces of legislation it thinks are important independently of the White House, and then the president can veto or not. But you have a incoming president who has such a hold over an entire party, who is through, you know, who has basically whipped his party into shape around him, wielding the power that he has. And he basically is going to get what he wants in the next 4 years, which is a very grim prospect. So he is speaking out against the Press Act, which is probably why the Senate hasn't picked up on it. Why? What are, as far as you can tell, what are the incoming president's motivations?
It's hard to say what his exact motivations are. Again, these protections are pretty fundamental. So the fact that he would speak out against them and decide to make a really public statement should raise alarm bells. But I think the alarms have been ringing for a long time around Donald Trump and his treatment of the press, both statements he has made explicitly around the targeting and prosecution and even jailing of journalists, his decisions to go after specific newsrooms, and then also the people in his immediate orbit who have also made similarly extreme statements about the press as the enemy of the people and potential prosecution of journalists. And so I think kind of his broader messaging and position towards the press should inform how we understand this opposition to what, again, are really basic protections for journalists and their sources.
If the worst case scenario plays out, if we enter 2025, where near the beginning of the year or shortly after the inauguration, we have the passage of H.R. 9495, the Press Act dying, and Trump going after his enemies in the media, what recourse does a free press have, or what recourse does a press have to preserve its freedoms, I should say? And, you know, the health of a democracy depends on a free press. Can our civil society, can our freedoms survive a world with Trump as president and H.R. 9495 or whatever it gets called in the end being wielded as his weapon?
That's a great question. I think there are kind of two pieces to it. One, there are still important legal protections for civil society and the press, the most important, of course, being the First Amendment. And so there are really robust legal protections that the reporters and their organizations can always fall back on. The threat of bills like H.R. 9495 and why something like the Press Act is so important, even if it's codifying pretty basic kind of common sense protections, is that the chilling environment that is created by a bill like 9495 and by the sense that the president might have this kind of unfettered discretion to go after dissenting voices, that's really the concern, because what the cost of mounting a legal challenge is still really significant. It's a lot of time, it's a lot of stress on organizations, on individual reporters. It'll keep them from doing the work that we critically need them to do to be an informed public. And so a lot of it is just kind of the red tape that it would tie organizations up with. And additionally, kind of the chilling effect, is it going to cause organizations to ask themselves, do we have the resources to fight this fight if we are targeted, and can we take that risk? So I think another really important point, in addition to remembering that there are legal protections, importantly the First Amendment, that exist, is that solidarity is going to be so important. We need all organizations in civil society, all members of the public who rely on civil society to engage in the political process, who rely on our local independent nonprofit newsrooms to get our news and to stay informed. We need people to be speaking out and to be supportive and to really push back. Like you mentioned, on 9495, there was a huge shift in even Democratic support for the bill initially, because there was such a groundswell of public support and people reached out and expressed their opposition. And so we're going to need that energy to continue. And we're going to need newsrooms, especially newsrooms that are larger with more resources, to speak up for independent and smaller nonprofit newsrooms who will most likely be more at risk because they simply don't have the resources to fight a long legal battle if they're targeted under a bill like HR 9495.
And of course, it's those smaller independent newsrooms that often have been the strongest critics of abuses of power because they don't have to often worry about upsetting or alienating advertisers and corporate sponsors. They are among the most independent in our media, and of course, by virtue of that, have the fewest resources to defend themselves. I speak from personal experience, and I know many of my fellow journalists in indie media also speak from there. So it is a grim next few years, and let's hope we can survive it all. I want to thank you so much for joining us, Jenna. Give out a website for Free Press's work.
You can find us at freepress.net, and we're at Free Press Action on TikTok, Instagram, all the social media.
Amazing. We'll link to that from our website. Thank you so much, Jenna.
Thank you.
My guest has been Jenna Ruddock, Policy Counsel at the media democracy organization Free Press, where her work focuses on digital civil rights, surveillance, protest, and tech. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, Senior Editor at Yes Media and host of Yes Presents Rising Up with Sonali. You can find this program at yesmagazine.org, watch it on Free Speech TV, and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. Our audio podcast is on iTunes and Spotify. This is Yes Presents Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, Senior Editor at Yes Media. You can find this program at yesmagazine.org, watch it on Free Speech TV, and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. In his new book, Building the Black City, The Transformation of American Life, Carnegie Mellon professor Joe Trotter Jr. explores the role of Black Americans in creating, sustaining, and expanding American cities all over the nation. He explores how African Americans launched cities from the ground up, often having to rebuild them after white mobs and capitalist forces destroyed them, how majority Black cities have existed within white-dominated cities, and how Black communities influenced the arts, economy, and politics of urban centers. Trotter's book, Building the Black City, chronicles 20 cities across 18 states from the colonial period to the Great Migration through to today. It's a story of history, capitalism, and reparations. Joe William Trotter Jr. is Giant Eagle University Professor of History and Social Justice and the director and founder of Carnegie Mellon University's Center for African American Urban Studies and the Economy. His earlier book was called Workers on Arrival, Black Labor in the Making of America. I had in fact spoken to him about that book. He now joins me to discuss his newest book, Building the Black City, The Transformation of American Life. Welcome to the program, Professor Joe Trotter.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
So the last time I interviewed you was about 6 years ago. We were discussing your book, Workers on Arrival, Black Labor in the Making of America. And I think this book follows really nicely from that because we're still talking about something that involves history and racial capitalism. And I'm excited to dig into it. Let's start with how you just define the Black city and how significant to this definition is the history of Black people in America in terms of a community historically having its movements controlled.
Yes, thank you very much. I'm happy to begin there. But I just want to reiterate that, yes, you did interview me several years ago, and it was on the book Workers on Arrival. And so this book, in some ways, is a sequel to that Workers on Arrival book. And so the Black City is really an effort on my part to document the many ways that African Americans managed to build their own city in their own interest, at the same time that their labor fueled the building of the big city, you know, the more predominantly white city. But you raise a good question about just how do we define, how do I define the Black City in the context of this book entitled Building the Black City? And this definition really is one that wrestles quite explicitly with some of the problematics around describing and defining African-American life in the urban areas as a process by which they built their own city. And let me just say that this notion of building the Black city is not entirely new, but it is fresh in the sense that very few scholars have tried to center this building of the Black infrastructure in a systematic way. And so let me say that there are several different ways that scholars have come at this notion of the Black city. And one of the most important ways actually occurred within the context of a recent edited volume that I participated in with a number of colleagues in the field. And that volume is called Black Urban History at the Crossroads. And it's sort of just a state of the field book that is a collection of essays of scholars who have written on different aspects of the Black urban experience. And so during the writing of that book, we were crafting an introduction to really help bring this book to the academic community, but also to the larger community. And so we confronted this issue of definition of Black city head on. And one of our colleagues named Leslie Harris, who is an outstanding historian of the African-American experience during the colonial era and the early national era in American history. And one of the issues she raised right away is that this notion of Black city really connotes a certain kind of power that African-Americans exercised over their environment. And her point was well taken because she underscored how there are very few places in which African-Americans in the United States could claim full autonomy over their space. And so our definition of the Black city necessarily had to transcend this idea of Blacks having total control over their environment. And so the definition that I employ tries to come to grip with that ideal. They use this spatial context in which they were able to gather and eventually expand their numbers. They use that land base, that geographical context, to construct churches, fraternal orders, and all kinds of entrepreneurial activities. And that was a major, you know, dimension of the Black city building process.
Let me ask you about some of the earliest examples of the Black city. You know, today we might think of a city like Atlanta, Washington, D.C. Historically, we might think of Greenwood in Tulsa, Oklahoma. But one of the things that I learned from your book very early on in your book, you talk about a Seneca Village in New York City. Tell me about Seneca Village and what it was and how its formation, but then also its destruction is symptomatic of the Black city.
Yes, thank you, Sonali. I am happy you use Seneca Village as an example and to bring out in this particular interview. Yes, in fact, I tried to call Seneca Village to the attention of our readers for this book early on, because I see Seneca Village as a kind of template, so to speak, of the Black urban experience. And the way Seneca Village got started is in the 1820s, a white landowner decided to sell property to an African-American bootblack, a man who was operating buildings, working at the lower end of the economic structure, a real working class African-American man. And he bought property there, and his property became a kind of beachhead whereby many other Blacks eventually made their way to this area that was called Seneca Village, that became known as Seneca Village. And it was the largest Black urban concentration in the country at that time. And it represented a place where African-Americans became landowners rather than just simply renters. And so over time, however, they thrived in that environment. But over time, by the 1850s, they came under great pressure from the city, and the settlement was in many ways simply demolished and displaced. And so we think about the urban renewal programs of the 1950s and the sort of New Deal era and the social welfare state era as the moment where Blacks suffer this tremendous process of urban renewal, which can be called urban displacement from their homes, from places that they had occupied historically. But this process of having to move and relocate in other parts of the city is a process with a long history stretching all the way back to the early 19th century at least, and Seneca Village demonstrates that. And the fact that the city displaced Blacks and built Central Park in that area, I think is very symbolic of the way in which African-American property has been destroyed in the interest of the larger white population. And in many ways, this kind of experience, you know, where Blacks are displaced from property for the benefit of whites, they sometimes cannot occupy and use those spaces in the way that the public is supposed to be able to use them, because there were many forms of racial discrimination that blocked African-American access to public places. And racism operated in a real way to doubly disadvantage the African-American population.
It isn't just, as your book illustrates so well, it isn't just a matter of congregating in one space. It's a matter of the architecture, building up the culture, the arts, the even the church, creating a sense, in the best sense, a city life that often then historically was stripped away from those communities. And so can you tell me about the cultural contributions to cities that Black communities have made, and how that becomes then a basis for reparations that's often left out of the conversation around reparations?
Yes, you're raising two questions about the cultural contributions of the Black city and about the relationship between these cultural contributions and the institutional infrastructure, institution building activities among Blacks. I think I'm going to turn to this question of the reparations one first, because I engaged that particular question up front. It's part of the rationale for the book. My ideal for the way in which the building of the Black city fits into an argument for reparation, it's a component of the reparations argument, but it's sort of a new and different slant on the reparation. When I started working on building the Black city, the theme and the argument from Workers on Arrival really helped to shape the way I developed this particular book. And in Workers on Arrival, if you recall, it really is about economic exploitation of Black labor. The displacement of Black people from their own property is another wealth, a sort of a dispossession of wealth among African Americans. And so there is a material dimension that runs through Workers on Arrival, in which I'm intent on underscoring the inequality, the economic inequality that existed over a long period of time from the transatlantic slave trade through the early 20th century or early 21st century now. And so that ideal of showing how Black people were dispossessed of the fruits of their labor and of their land and their resources in other ways, that means that we have to paint a real picture of the way African people were victimized by racial capitalism and by the way in which their labor was deployed to enrich others. And so we want to make that point so pointedly and so emphatically that it sometimes overshadows the second component of African American life, and that is the way in which their labor, they double tax. I'm going to repeat that again. They double tax themselves and their own labor. Sometimes they worked all day in the sort of mainstream economy. They came home at night and helped build churches, repair homes, and to really build their city. Also, in many ways, they carried out agricultural activities in the city on some plots of land where they may have started a garden to really supply their own needs. So there is a way in which we, in looking at the exploitation, the deprivation, we sometimes camouflage the degree to which African Americans are parlaying their labor power into a system, building a system that serves their own needs. And so here's my point about the reparations item. Reparations, I argue, should not be relegated only to the inequality that Black people face in the economy. That we have to add to the reparations argument that at the same time that they were enriching others, they were also improving their own lives through building their own city. And that form of creativity should be factored in alongside the exploitative dimensions of the urban economy and the way that Black people manage to participate in it. So that's the relationship to the reparations story, is that we have to couple our arguments about reparation with this dynamic creativity on the part of Black people. And in many ways, that just underscores the injustice more, because, and it also answers a real critical question that at least white supremacists, you know, analysts over a period of time, and that's one of the things Workers on Arrival tried to show, that Black people were never these so-called lazy, unenergetic, sluggish workers and unproductive workers. And so in many ways, that emphasis on creativity sort of underscore that Black people, and it demolishes any idea that Black people were not worthy or deserving, you know, of repayment, of recompense. And so that's the side on the reparations issue. On the other side of the equation, we have given a lot of attention in the historical literature on the degree to which African-American labor definitely, you know, fuel all kind of building, whether it's art, you know, museum, capital buildings, commercial establishments, you know, they added to all of that. But on this cultural side, we have also started to acknowledge the way that African Americans impacted, you know, the culture of the country and of the world, and most notably, the music, you know, has been a major way in which African Americans have been acknowledged. And in this book, I treat the African-American culture and institution-building activities as something that not only served the needs of African-Americans, but that it also affected the larger built environment of the city, broadly conceived, so that we have to begin seeing how African-Americans influenced the culture through their church building activities, for example. And their beliefs and practices were not limited to the church. Black religion also helped to reshape the religious landscape of the city. It created a more dynamic, fluid, and diverse religious environment. And you can go down the line with African-American influencing the culture. And even we're talking about all of these sort of legitimate ways in which Black people participated and influenced the culture. And I would say Black journalism is another major way. Across the country, African-Americans are creating these newspapers, and California is a major site of major newspaper production. And the idea is that American journalism was challenged by African-American journalism. And even though they may have, their ideals may have been rejected and critiqued as, you know, insufficient, they still offered alternative ways of thinking about the way people live their lives, especially African-American, when the mainstream media was overlooking so much about Black life, especially the cultural life of the Black community. These Black journalists were uncovering that, and they were celebrating Black culture in the context of Black newspapers. And Black newspapers, although serving the African-American community, those newspapers had an impact on American journalism more generally.
Well, unfortunately, we're out of time, but I want to thank you so much for joining us today, Professor Joe Trotter. There's so much more we could talk about. I certainly encourage readers to pick up a copy of your book, Building the Black City. Thank you. I appreciate your time.
Okay.
My guest has been Joe William Trotter, Jr., Giant Eagle University Professor of History and Social Justice, and director and founder of Carnegie Mellon University's Center for African American Urban Studies and the Economy. And we've been discussing his new book, Building the Black City, The Transformation of American Life. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, senior editor at Yes Media and host of Yes Presents, Rising Up with Sonali. You can find this program at yesmagazine.org, watch it on Free Speech TV, and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. Our audio podcast is on iTunes and Spotify. This is Yes Presents Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, senior editor at Yes Media. You can find this program at yesmagazine.org, watch it on Free Speech TV, and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. It's been nearly 40 years since the world's worst industrial disaster claimed the lives of thousands of people and continues to impact more than 500,000. Justice is elusive for the survivors of the Bhopal disaster in India, who are living with the impacts of an unprecedented chemical leak from a plant run by Union Carbide Corporation in 1984. Dow Chemical, which owns Union Carbide, has refused to properly compensate victims or conduct a thorough cleanup. Litigation is ongoing in both India and the United States. Amnesty International, which has been documenting the disaster for years, has just released a new report called Bhopal, 40 Years of Injustice. And my guest is Mark Dummett, Head of Business and Human Rights at Amnesty. Welcome to the program, Mark.
Thanks so much, Sonali.
So it's quite interesting that there's very little awareness here in the United States as a whole of what happened in Bhopal, even though currently it's an American company that is on the is on the hot seat, if you will. And it was, as I mentioned, the world's worst industrial disaster. But perhaps because it happened 40 years ago, memory seems to have faded. And yet this is an issue that is, in Bhopal especially, absolutely not a thing of the past, right? How are people still living with the impacts of this disaster nearly 40 years later?
Well, that's right. It isn't a historical case. It's not a historical disaster. It's a disaster which began in 1984, on the 2nd of December 1984, but it's continuing today. And that's why Amnesty International continues to beat the drum, as it were, on behalf of the survivors of this terrible disaster, to promote their voices and to share their stories of suffering and resilience in the face of this, you know, absolutely appalling tragedy. As you said, thousands of people died within days. 500,000 people have suffered from life-defining injuries as a result of this chemical leak. And the vast majority are incredibly poor already. So as well as the physical suffering that they've had to endure, the injuries have also pushed them further into poverty. And the various efforts by the Indian government, by the American companies involved, Union Carbide, which was American, and Dow Chemicals, which then bought out Union Carbide, the various efforts to provide compensation, to provide healthcare, have been incredibly, utterly inadequate. It is a terrible story of injustice, of a failure to hold this company to account, of a failure to look after the survivors of this disaster. It is a story of two countries, India and America. And one of the things the campaigners have always said is, would this have happened in the US, if an American company had caused such a terrible toxic leak, what would have happened? Would they have responded differently? And I think the answer is absolutely yes. They would have responded differently if the disaster had happened at home in the US.
So there's so many different angles on the injustices that continue. 40 years, as we said, is a long time. There have been several generations of people born since then. How has the contamination that continues in that area impacted either genetically through genetics passed down from parent to child, or from existing environmental contamination from 1984? How has that impacted younger generations of people in Bhopal?
Right, it's a really good question and an important issue, this. And I mean, to me, it is the most shocking aspect of this whole sad story. And it's a reason why we've included in our report actually quite a lot of photos, photographs taken of the survivors and their children, because what we're seeing now in Bhopal is a third generation of people being born, of children being born, obviously, with congenital disorders. So the impact of this appalling toxic chemical has been passed down now to a third generation and is causing injury to newborns and has caused injury to young children. That's one side. You also talk about the pollution which is still there. And that's because the factory site was never properly cleaned up after the disaster. And the contaminants on the site, and this is a plant, a chemicals plant, which was built in this city in central India, the contaminants continue to leak, to leach into the groundwater. The groundwater which provides drinking water to tens of thousands of people. And they're continuing to be poisoned by this water. And according to researchers working on behalf of some of the community health groups, which have been organized by the survivors and their supporters globally, including many in the US, who have donated to some of these healthcare initiatives. According to this research, this water has continued to spread. This poisoned water has continued to spread. So today, 40 years after the disaster, or almost 40 years after the disaster, even more people are being impacted in this absolutely dreadful way.
So when we think about what is needed, you know, immediately comes to mind, well, why haven't survivors sued Dow Chemical? Why haven't they tried to hold this company accountable legally? How much is complicated by the fact that we're talking about Indian survivors and a U.S. legal system that's, you know, on the other side of the planet? And we're talking, as you said earlier, about poor people and a rich corporation. What is the status of the litigation?
The litigation, incredibly, has gone on all this time. It is due to a large part down to the strength, the commitment to the bravery of survivor groups that the litigation has continued. They are incredibly strong campaigners fighting on behalf of a much wider group of people. And it's thanks to them that this issue is really still alive, that you know, they're the ones who are motivating groups like Amnesty to speak out about it. And I think, to answer the first bit of your question in terms of what's the solution has got to involve has got to involve them. They've got to be at the center. The survivor groups have got to be at the center of any solution. Dow Chemicals has got to talk to them. The U.S. government, the Indian government, they all need to come together and to come up with a solution to this multifaceted problem involving all these health issues that I was describing, the socioeconomic problems as well, the contaminated waste which still hasn't been cleaned up. This all needs to be fixed. Now, yes, there have been a number of court battles in the U.S. A U.S. judge dismissed the claims brought by survivors in the US, stating that India was the correct jurisdiction for these claims to be heard. In India, the Indian government did reach an out-of-court settlement with Union Carbide over compensation, but the amount they agreed to was woefully inadequate. It was a fraction of the amount that the Indian government had previously assessed was needed to properly compensate the survivors of this disaster.
Was this the $500 that someone commented was more than enough for an Indian?
Right, exactly. It was an utterly, as I said, inadequate amount. The survivors pushed for many years to get the Indian Supreme Court to overrule that settlement, but that the Supreme Court ruled against them last year. And then there's a separate thread, which was a criminal case, which was brought by the Indian authorities against company managers or factory managers, including Warren Anderson, who was the head of Union Carbide. He was arrested when he was in India just days after the accident, but then after the US government put pressure on the Indians, he was released. The criminal case saw a group of Indian company managers actually go to jail for a period of time for their negligent actions, which contributed to the disaster. But the American accused have never been extradited from the US. So one of the calls that the campaigners have always asked for, and Amnesty as well, is calling on the US government to make sure that those accused do face justice in the US, are extradited. Although, of course, it's many years ago, and several have passed away in the intervening period.
What about grassroots efforts to support the survivors? You mentioned that there have been some efforts around healthcare, and even some that are funded by individual donors here in the United States, progressive-minded individuals, justice-minded people. What are some of the ways in which you're seeing grassroots efforts to help the victims, and also ways in which those here in the United States are showing solidarity?
It's so important, this international solidarity for the survivors. Anyone listening to this can just go into Google and search for the Bhopal Medical Appeal or the International Campaign for Justice for Bhopal and see for themselves on those websites what the survivors and their international supporters are doing to bring essential healthcare to tens of thousands of people, to continue to fight for accountability and justice. It's quite extraordinary the extent to which, you know, 40 years on, as I've said before, they're continuing to push for justice. And one of the reasons why we wanted to put this report out now was to draw attention to, you know, to some of their successes as well, that they've had, some of their small victories that they've had in terms of being able to provide extra support to the survivors. The other thing I would say in terms of what people can do to support them is to put pressure on Dow Chemicals. And last week we made a call directly to the companies, most of which, or the largest of which, are US firms, those investing in Dow, to use their influence on the company to force it to go to the table to come up with an adequate compensation package for the survivors. Dow's response is outrageous. Dow's response is that it is not responsible, because at the time of the disaster, the factory was operated by Union Carbide, and it only bought Union Carbide 16 years after the disaster. But of course, it has bought the company. It has also bought everything that the company does and had done. It ultimately remains responsible for providing remedy for the victims of this disaster.
And I imagine that Dow tries to use plausible deniability in avoiding accountability, saying that that it's not responsible because Union Carbide was responsible. But if you buy a company, you buy everything that goes with it.
Right, exactly. And I mean, you go onto Dow's website, or you check out Dow's Twitter feed. It presents itself as a very sustainable, a very ethical organization, a company that cares about diversity and inclusion. But at the same time, it is refusing calls from the survivors to provide adequate compensation for this disaster. And I think if there's anything that we can do as activists, it is to try and put pressure on Dow in whatever way we can to use some of its absolutely enormous wealth to provide this meaningful remedy that the people deserve.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Mark, for joining us. Is there a website? Can you give out Amnesty's website where people can get a hold of the report themselves?
Amnesty.org. Very simple.
And we'll post a link to that from our site as well. Thank you so much, Mark, for joining us.
Thank you so much, Sonali.
My guest has been Mark Dummett, Head of Business and Human Rights at Amnesty International. This December, it'll be 40 years since the Bhopal chemical disaster, the world's worst industrial accident. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, Senior Editor at Yes Media and host of Yes Presents Rising Up with Sonali. You can find this program at yesmagazine.org, watch it on Free Speech TV, and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. Our audio podcast is on iTunes and Spotify.
Divertimento. I am here in a land of happy, freaky people. KBOO Portland.
KBOO's 2024 Catalog of Connections is hot off the presses.